Case number 20-3004, Maybelle Smith et al. Versus Continental Casualty Company. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Shingold, you may proceed for the appellants.
Thank you, Deputy Milton. Zach Shingold appearing on behalf of plaintiffs. We're reserving 3 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honors. Good morning, Your Honors. Under the laws of Ohio and Florida, the long-term care insurance contracts that plaintiffs had with defendant formed new contracts when the policies renewed annually and the plaintiffs took the affirmative steps.
Can I ask you, I'm sorry to interrupt you. So can I ask you just a quick jurisdictional question? I'm curious. This case was brought under CAFA, right? Why, and I take it, maybe I'll ask your friend on the other side. I don't know whether there's a consensus on whether there are 100 plaintiffs in this case. It was never resolved, I guess, because there's not been a class certification adjudication here. But is there any reason why this wouldn't be just a normal diversity case either?
I believe it was brought under CAFA because the expectation is that the total damages exceed more than $5 million and there would be more than 100 plaintiffs. I think Mr. Austin might be in a better position to answer that. I don't believe that was challenged at the lower court level.
But there is complete diversity, right?
There is
complete diversity. Named plaintiffs and the defendant. And they each have more than $75,000 at stake?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. The trial court, because the policies did form new contracts upon the renewal, the trial court erred when it upheld the defendant's use of an unlawful 3-day prior hospitalization requirement to deny plaintiffs the benefits to which they were entitled after having paid tens of thousands of dollars of premium over a combined 50 years. And for plaintiffs,
can I ask under your theory of the case, I'm trying to understand what some of the provisions of the contract would mean under your theory of the case. So effective date is used in a few places. For instance, the 6-month ban on service from pre-existing conditions starts with the effective date. Is it your view that the meaning of the phrase effective date would be the renewal each year, so that 6-month period would actually be renewed each year? So there's a 6-month time period where pre-existing conditions wouldn't be covered year after year after year?
To answer the second question, Judge Murphy, no. From what we can see in the Smith policy, effective date when capitalized refers to the effective date of the original coverage. Effective date when non-capitalized refers to the effective date of each subsequent renewal. For Ms. Fleming, effective date is defined, but the definition is so broad that it could easily encompass sort of a delineation between the effective date of the original coverage and then effective date of renewals following the initial term.
Okay. And what about, the Ohio provision has guarantee that we can't change the terms. Would that guarantee, how would it work? I mean, that guarantee strikes me as toothless if it's, oh yeah, we can't change your terms for a year, but then with each new contract, we could add whatever terms we want to add. It seems like that what Smith and Fleming are purchasing is a guarantee the terms won't change for the life of the contract. But if we interpret contract to just be 1 year, That seems to be outside what their expectations of what they were purchasing, which is their lifetimes.
And I think that delineation, Judge Murphy, between guaranteed renewable and guaranteed for life is something that defendants have certainly tried to emphasize. But it's important to note that these policies are issued within the confines of the relevant statutory scheme. So there are limitations on what the insurers can do. For example, 39-2344B says that an insurer can't cancel, terminate, or non-renew because of age or physical deterioration or other senescence. So that's
because that does that provision. I'm confused. So you haven't disputed the point that the hospitalization provision is not retroactive. It seems that that provision was adopted very similar in time to this other provision. I might be mistaken on my history of the statutory scheme, but that other provision might not necessarily apply if it's not retroactive either.
That provision, Judge Murphy, was there as part of the original law. The three-day prior hospitalization was adopted afterwards. And if, as you see in the law, there's nothing that prohibits subsequent incorporation of the three-day prior, of the prohibition on hospitalization into subsequent long-term care insurance contracts as they renew. The key issue is there a renewal? And did it turn into a new contract? And I might be able to sort of focus the issue.
Is that a new, if it's a new contract, is it being renewed or you're entering into a new agreement? And the insurance company doesn't have to enter into the new agreement if they don't want to, do they? Or it's a guarantee, it's a new contract that they have to enter into. Is that your position?
If you look at it in terms of the way we look at, say, Benson or Francis and the case law following that, Ohio law says there's a 2-year guaranteed renewable period for certain type of motorist coverage insurance. But that doesn't mean that there can't be periods or smaller periods of term contract. So the answer is the insurer is able to raise the premium, to make an offer, to say, hey, here's an increase in premium, and the insured is capable of saying no or accepting that. So for example, in 2003, the insured sent a letter to Ms. Smith saying, we're going to increase your premiums, but you're gonna retain the same benefits. So it's gonna be, if you wanna retain the same benefits, it's gonna be $763.64. Here's another offer. We can also decrease your premium or keep your premium, but decrease your benefits. And then of course, there's the tacit offer of, you don't have to accept this. You can just not pay anything in the future. So there's three different offers on the table in 2003. Because that offer was after the prohibition on prior hospitalization under 392344S, that offer could not include any sort of prior hospitalization requirement. And we but see that they, manifested.
I guess my question in Ohio, at least, did they have to make any offer at all? I mean, did they have to renew any contract?
That's my question too.
I mean, I don't, could they have just said, we're done. We don't, you're getting older. We don't want to cover you anymore. We're done.
Well, no, that's prohibited by law, Judge Nalbandian. And that's why
the law only covers age, health. What if they just wanted to get out of the business? That wouldn't be covered by the law you cited to us, because it wouldn't be based on age, health. It's based on unrelated business reasons.
And Continental is out of the business, but it still has an obligation to keep these policies.
But only if it's a long-term contract, not if it's a contract that they can. You've cited us a statute that says you're not allowed to discriminate based on age or health, but it doesn't say they can't end the contract renewal period or if it's not a long-term contract based on other reasons. And if the other reasons are business reasons, it certainly wouldn't fall within the law that you cited to us in your reply brief, because it wouldn't be based on her age or health. And so wouldn't that be outside, kind of inconsistent with the expectations of the parties, that this is a guaranteed long-term contract and you're stuck with it even if your business changes?
I suppose that's one possible interpretation, but the question is, what are the reasonable interpretations? And is there a reasonable interpretation that plaintiff can put forth that says this contract renewed? And if you look at the amended policy schedule at page 146 that was provided to Plaintiff Smith's family after the 2003 letter, you'll see that there is no 3-day prior hospitalization requirement. Now, if you compare that with the amended policy schedule that was submitted by defendants, I think it's on page 87, maybe 86, they do have a 3-day prior hospitalization requirement. So if we look at the 2003 letter, and we look at the fact that the subsequent amended policy schedule has that premium amount, $763.64, as both the first and the renewal premium, and there's no three-day prior hospitalization requirement, the suggestion there, and the most reasonable interpretation, is that there was an offer and there was an acceptance, and because 392344S prohibited the inclusion of a prior hospitalization requirement in that offer, that's why there is no three-day prior hospitalization in the subsequent amended policy schedule.
Can I ask a question? I want to follow up on Judge Nalbandian's question. I thought he asked pretty clearly, is the theory here that the insurance company is required by the original contract to enter into or to offer a second contract? You said a lot of stuff, but I didn't get the answer to that question.
I think by law, the insurance company is required to offer a second contract, but there's nothing that requires the plaintiff to accept that second contract. Right.
Well, you say by law, but not by contract, because the law has exceptions, as Judge Murphy has pointed out. But if you read the contract as requiring the ability to enter into a new contract at the discretion of one of the parties, it could be a new contract that's required by the terms of the old contract. And if you think of it that way, your position would seem to be much stronger, but you seem to be reluctant to characterizing it that way. And that's why I'm asking the question.
No, Judge Rogers, you're correct. That is one interpretation. I think it's a good interpretation to say the policy says, the first contract says, we're going to make you an offer and we will make you an offer. And as long as you accept the offer for the renewal policy, it becomes a new renewal term. Now, your policy will only be in force for the actual period that you're paying on. So the first premium is only consideration for the first policy term. And if you want any policy coverage in the second term or any renewal term, you're going to have to pay a renewal premium. And that's consistent with Francis and Dixon and Benson and Gibbons Berry. And I see that my time is out.
Yes. You've got, I think you reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll hear you on rebuttal. Let's hear from counsel for the appellee.
Good morning, may it please the court. This is Brent Austin on behalf of Continental Casualty. Judge Nalbandian, just to answer your question about jurisdiction, I think there would be jurisdiction. The issue, plaintiffs and the defendant don't agree on the number of class members. By plaintiff's class definition, there likely would be more than 100. We don't think it's a valid class definition for a lot of reasons that aren't before the court today, but that doesn't affect CAFA jurisdiction. And as you noted, there is complete diversity for ordinary diversity jurisdiction as well. And that's why we haven't challenged jurisdiction. I think it's important to begin by focusing on two core propositions, or perhaps three. The first is, what is the intention of this policy? And there is only one policy, and the policy, neither the policy nor the law says to Continental, you must offer a new policy each year. Instead, what the policy said is, when you offer and issue a long-term care policy in either of these states, it must be guaranteed renewable. The policy says it must be guaranteed renewable. The regs in Ohio say it must be guaranteed renewable, and the regs in Florida say it must be renewable. And the reason for that is because the purpose of this contract is, it's described in the industry as a long tail contract, which means if you buy, the younger you buy it, the lower your rate will be that you pay over time with the expectation that you would go on claim years later. And just as one example from the structure of the policy, and I want to talk more about the structure of the policy because I think that really informs intent, but there is a provision on page 7 of the Smith policy and page 8 of the Fleming policy, and it reads as follows. After your policy has, this is a quote, has been in force for 2 years, no misstatements except fraudulent misstatements made by you in the application shall be used to void the policy or to deny a claim for loss incurred after the 2 year period. Now, there is no way to square that hole. if a policy can be enforced for 2 years or more than 2 years, which is what this contemplates, that demonstrates the intention of the policy is to continue on for years. The policy says so, and the applicable regulations say so.
What do you do with the counterpoint, I suppose, is the Ohio cases at least seem to draw a pretty significant distinction between use of the word renewal versus use of the word extension. And when they use, they suggest that when contracts use the word renewal, that they are actually engaged in seriatim contracts, so one contract after another. So this contract does use the term, the phrase renew more than the phrase extension. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. The Ohio cases that you're talking about all involve either auto policies or homeowners policies where an auto claim is being asserted, you know, on the homeowners policy. And in all of those cases, the conclusion hinged on whether or not the intention of the renewal was to create a new contract or to continue an old contract. And in each one of those cases, the conclusion was that the intention was to enter into a new contract because of factors like there's a clear beginning and ending date. Most or all of them emphasize that it ends at 12:01 a.m. standard time on the ending date. Nothing like that exists here. Here, the policy is structured to continue on. Now, the guaranteed renewal provision, I think, demonstrates pretty clearly that both the Ohio legislature and the regulators and the Florida legislature and the regulators understood perfectly well what renewal meant in this context and how it was completely different from issuing or delivering an insurance policy. The one, I think, there's no dispute among the parties that the former issue or issue for delivery constitutes a new contract. That's not what we have here. We have a renewal. And the intention of the renewal in this case was to continue on with an existing contract. And the Yoder Court talks about offer and acceptance. You can't have a new contract unless there's offer, acceptance, and consideration. CNA is not allowed to offer anything after this contract is entered into. We can't change the rates unless we do it on a class-wide basis, and I want to talk about that a bit in a minute. But it's explicit, and Judge Murphy, this goes to your question about wanting to drop a policy because of business reasons unrelated to age or health. On the first page of the policy, it says, quote, "We can make no change to your policy without your consent." So the company could be going broke and it could not change a term of this policy. All it could do is go back to the state regulator and ask for a rate increase, or in an extreme situation, I believe Florida and probably Ohio as well, allows a regulator to essentially cancel a policy if the company is becoming insolvent. But none of that is an issue here.
Can I ask you a question about Florida? And I understand Ohio, there may be some distinction between auto and homeowner cases and renewals versus renewals that aren't guaranteed, for example, and the obligation on the insurer. But in Florida, we do have a case that involves a long-term kind of health care contract, right, with this Bell Care case. And I'm wondering why we shouldn't just follow that. Isn't that the easiest path here?
No, Bell Care doesn't change the result of the district court's rulings. Bell Care involved a statute that explicitly contemplated renewals. It quotes it on page 17 of the opinion. So right there, the statute on its face is distinguishable. And the key to the Bell Care decision was the court's conclusion that the company, obviously Continental Casualty, had, quote, an absolute right to terminate the policy and had an absolute right to change the premium policy. And that holding was repeated again in James v. Hartford Life. CNA doesn't have that right in the policies that are before the court today. And the Bell Care case did not go into the analysis of the structure of the policy that we provide in the brief. Bell Care didn't go into the case law that we cite in the brief. In fairness, some of the case law came after Bell Care, but it's not discussed in Bell Care. And Bell Care doesn't talk about the structure of the policy. And as I said, the guaranteed renewable provision explicitly says CNA cannot change this policy. It can't cancel the policy. And Judge Murphy, you asked about
business. They can't change the policy by raising the rates, right?
That is the only way that they can do it.
It's a pretty significant way. I mean, if you raise the rates substantially.
But that's an, excuse me, Judge Rogers.
I'm finished.
That is a contract right that was agreed to when the policy was formed back in 1988 and 1989, depending on the plaintiff that you're talking about. It's never changed. It's the required, it has four conditions to do a rate increase, and all of those conditions generally track regulations on rate increases in both Ohio and Florida. The company can only raise a rate if it does it on a class-wide basis of policyholders with the same form in the same state and in the same rating class. And that is important because it was agreed to at the time. So it is a right that CNA has. CNA has a right to collect premium, has a right to raise rates under those terms, but under the law, under both Ohio and Florida, CNA cannot raise those rates unless it files for approval of the rate structure.
Can I ask a question about that? Because there was seemed to be a little bit of confusion on that issue. In again, back to Florida, you have to file the proposed rate increase with some regulator in Florida, and then my understanding is if they don't do anything, it is deemed approved. But I guess they could disapprove it if they want. I mean, in other words, do you need their explicit or implicit consent in order to raise the rate?
You absolutely do. I mean, you have no choice but to file for the rate increase. And they're fairly detailed regulations for what you have to file and then subsequent filings that you have to make. And all of those are detailed in the regs. The difference, though, between this and a term policy is that in a term policy, like an auto policy, everybody knows if you have accidents during the term of the policy, your next term could have a premium increase in it. CNA can't do that in this case. The only way that a rate increase can happen in this case, if it's on a class-wide basis, and that's because the laws in Ohio and Florida and probably most other states say that long-term care policies are designed to cover a long span of time, and therefore the company's right to change the policy is eliminated. And if you can't change the policy, if you can't change a term of the policy, then there's no offer and acceptance.
Could I ask a question about the Judge Nalbandi, and I didn't mean to interrupt the train of your question. I want to ask a practical question about the nature of this exception. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
If someone is denied because of this, can they then go into the hospital and then get coverage after that? Or is it gone forever because they started without having been in the hospital for 3 days?
I think the conclusion would be that once they satisfied the 3-day hospitalization, that would trigger the coverage. If they were not hospitalized,
they get turned down and then they go into the hospital and now they'll get granted. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
The insurance policy says?
Yes.
I see.
That's the way the policy works. But I mean, all of these 3-day hospitalization requirements function that way. And obviously the legislatures in Ohio and Florida deemed it was inappropriate to have policies that way. And so they passed laws prospectively saying, for future policies that are issued or issued for delivery in this state, you can't include a 3-day hospitalization.
I understand what the change is. I'm trying to see how the old system worked, just how much. How many would you say, if you know, or it's a rough percentage, how many times does one of these applications get denied on the basis of that? Is it like half of them or two-thirds of them or something?
This goes to the dispute over the size of the class. According to company records memorialized in an interrogatory response, there are somewhere between 20 and 30 policyholders that had experienced a denial of a claim on this basis. And that includes Plaintiff Smith and Plaintiff Fleming. The plaintiffs contend
all,
that the class
all ever or plaintiffs. I don't understand what the denominator is for those 20 people.
I believe that the calculation went back to the statute of limitations period. But I haven't read that interrogatory response in some time. So I'd have to be cautious.
You have a general feel for how often this is used to deny benefits. Well, it would seem like it would be frequent that people are going to want
to based on the analysis
without going to the hospital.
Based on the analysis that CNA did, they concluded that it was not frequently occurring, that it was somewhere between 20 and 30. Again, the time period, I'd have to look at the interrogatory response, which I don't have in front of me. I think it's cited in the, I believe it's cited in the record. It's certainly cited in the motion to dismiss and motion for summary judgment. But we're talking about a small universe of people that are affected by this requirement.
What's the point of the requirement?
I believe the requirement originated in the Medicare statute, and it was, there's basically, different policies have different, they call them benefit triggers or thresholds to get into, to gain coverage. There's ADL requirements, cognitive impairment requirements. It's all essentially geared toward.
But that's the history, but I'm asking, and pardon me for interrupting, but I'm asking for whether there's policy in it the way it's interpreted, the way it's applied, and the way you want to continue to apply it to people who got their original coverage earlier. I'm wondering if is there any insurance, I don't want to say policy because the word has different meanings, but any purpose to that kind of a limitation? Is it relate
yes,
to, being able to deny it to a certain number of people, is there anything that relates it rationally to the insurance?
I believe that the purpose of the requirement was to essentially function as a gatekeeper function that defines the level of sickness that someone has that's going on claim. That was its rationale back in the 1980s. Obviously, CNA doesn't sell these policies. I mean, CNA doesn't sell any policies anymore, but it stopped selling the three-day hospitalization policies after these laws took effect.
Can I ask real quick, about Judge Rogers suggested that maybe this the one concern I had for the other side was whether this is actually a workable approach under the contract, having it be year by year. But why wouldn't it be a workable approach if you interpret the contract to be saying the old contract gives you an absolute right for CNA to make an offer of a new contract? That would in some sense make sense to me under the contract regime. With respect to the concerns I was talking about to the other side. So I wonder if you could respond to that quickly.
Sure. An offer can be made only if you have something to offer. And the offer that was made here was to issue this policy. And by issuing the policy stipulates that thereafter you can't terminate it or cancel it or change it without the consent of the policyholder. There's no bilateral exchange of offer and acceptance here. Once the policy is entered, the only person that can cancel the policy is the policyholder. And Judge Burke, you asked early about canceling for business reasons other than age or health. And I want to be clear about this because the age or health distinction is for rate increases. It's not for cancelization. There is no way for the company to cancel this policy other than in the extreme situation where it's going insolvent. And as I said, when you look at how the policy is structured, there's nothing in there that would ever suggest that CNA is obligated to make a new offer each year. But saying someone is obligated to enter into a contract each year is the same thing as saying somebody is in a continuing contractual obligation, because CNA can't get out of the contractual obligation, absent things like fraud in the application, which largely gets eliminated after 2 years. And again, you can't have a policy that talks about being enforced for 2 years and conclude, therefore, that it is a one-year term policy that ends on a date certain, even though there is no date certain. There's also no new policy number. And the Francis Court at Star 8 emphasizes the absence of a policy number and the absence of or the presence of underwriting, or the absence of underwriting as being key factors in determining whether there was an intent to create a new contract. Neither of those exist here. And if you look at the
council, could I see your time is up. I wonder if I could ask Judge Nalbandian to ask him a short question.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
What would be your position on sending this quintessentially state law issued by certification to the Supreme Court of Ohio?
The federal court is completely competent to.
I understand we're competent. Go ahead.
So, obviously, I cite federal cases that address these same issues without regard to going to the state Supreme Court.
So you'd be opposed to that?
I would. I would. Well, I think you. The district court decision.
My question. Thank you.
Is that the same for Florida too?
Yes, I think that the district court's decision should be affirmed on the terms that set forth in the district court's opinion.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Austin, for your argument. And we'll hear rebuttal now from the plaintiff.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Nalbandian. And I'll just quickly point to James at note 3 and Wolf at 43 to talk about the issue, a delivery issue that Mr. Austin raised. And Dixon at 22 to talk about the issue about whether or not the broad principles in Benson and Preston apply to more than homeowners and auto insurance contracts. I think it's pretty important to note that Bell Care, we have the same policy language, we have the same law, and we've got the same interpretation, including even the same defendant. There really is no real legitimate difference.
One thing about Bell Care, though, there's no real discussion of some of the policy terms. Is there some of the terms, and I don't know whether they existed in that case or not, but the 2-year limit on the insurance company bringing up misstatements, for example, that's an argument that's tough for your side, isn't it? It doesn't really make any sense if it renews every year. Why do you have this 2-year limit on when they can raise this defense? Was that something that was in the insurance policy in Bell Care and it just didn't come up, or was it not in those policies, or do we even know?
Judge Nalbandian, I don't know. I will tell you that since 1956, under 392304, that particular type of clause has been a required disclosure in all health and sickness insurance contracts. If you look at 392304B1, that's just required contract language. That's something that Continental's required to put in there. And I believe, but I'm not
okay,
exactly
but what
sure.
About, okay, what about the 5-year maximum coverage period, which seems a little bit odd also if this were just serial renewed contracts? I mean, I guess I'm just wondering about some of these provisions that seem like the end date, the begin date, in Bell Care, were those policies, did they have these same provisions that the other side is pointing to, I guess, and would be much easier for us to say, oh, they had the exact same provisions in Bell Care and came out this way, or do we just not know?
We don't know. What we do know is that Bell Care is the law of Florida, and there's the petition for cert was denied by the Supreme Court. We have no indication, there's no data that suggests that the Florida Supreme Court would rule differently on effectively identical policy language. I see I'm running out of time. So I do want to quickly note that in Francis, the issue with underwriting or the issue with a policy number, under the policy number argument, Benson, Givens, Barry, Dixon, there's no indication that any of those would be considered renewable if you make policy number change a litmus test. And that's the problem. The trial court created a whole series of litmus tests under which most of the other policies, most of the other cases would not have actually been able to be considered renewed contracts. If you look at what the Ohio courts look to, whether the policy was a specified term, whether a renewal premium put in forth a new term, and whether loss was covered only during that period, Smith policy under Ohio is a term policy where the contract renews at each and performs a new contract at each renewal.
Okay, great, great. Thank
Could
you.
I ask for one sentence from Mr. Shangold on whether he would advocate sending this to the state?
Absolutely.
Certified, one sentence.
Judge Rogers, on the issue of whether a term policy with a beginning date and a renewal term, such as annual, is not legally different from a term policy and a beginning date and an end date 1 year later, yes, that we ask that that be certified to the court. The
Supreme thank court.
Thank you.
So you're, okay, Ohio only, or would you also want certification to Florida?
That's just Ohio, and based upon the trial court's decision, we believe BellCare is on all fours, and BellCare should totally guide the Florida, the decision for Ms. Fleming.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments, and the case will be submitted.